Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take the comprehensive source material you send us, we dig through it, every credit, every little detail, and basically give you the full picture so you're really well informed.
Yeah, that's the plan.
And our mission today, it's exploring a career that's, well, it's less like a straight road and more like a sprawling map. We're talking about maximum professional versatility here.
We are. We're charting the path of Stephen Douglas Agee.
Yeah.
And it's kind of unlikely in some ways, but also really strategic when you look closely.
How so?
Well, he went from being this niche alt comedy writer, musician guy, you know, loved by a pretty small dedicated crowd.
Right, like the Sarah Silverman program era.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
To becoming like a core part of one of the biggest superhero franchises out there. A recurring operational asset, as the sources kind of put it.
That's a great way to phrase it, operational asset.
Yeah. And that whole journey, for you listening, it really is like a masterclass in adapting professionally. How to stay relevant, how to shift gears.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Because, yeah, it is a monumental journey. When you actually lay out all the credits of your filmography, it honestly looks like maybe two, even three different careers running side by side.
It really does.
It's this dichotomy that's just, it's rare and probably incredibly hard to keep going. So we're talking Stephen Douglas Agee, born 69, right? So he's 56 in 2025.
Yep. Riverside, California native. Professional career kicking off around 2000.
And that central duality you mentioned, that's really the key, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's the core thing to grasp. For years, for a lot of people, Steve Agee was Steve Myron.
Or Stephen Ned Myron III sometimes.
Right. Exactly. From the Sarah Silverman program. That character, that show, it was peak early 2000s Comedy Central.
Hmm.
Super surreal, very specific humor.
Oh, yeah. Often kind of awkward, uncomfortable, self-referential, that whole vibe.
Totally. And that character, Steve Myron, he was just perfect for it. Sort of the perpetual underdog, the sad, sincere guy in this completely bonkers world Sarah Silverman created.
He really grounded it in a weird way. But then, like you said, the pivot happens.
Yeah.
And it's a massive one. Suddenly, he's John Economos.
Yeah, John Economos, the super stressed out, bureaucratic tech guy.
Yeah.
You know, often hilariously miserable working for Amanda Waller.
Right. Trying to manage Task Force X and all that chaos in the DCEU and now the new DCU.
And we're talking a huge shift in scale here, going from, you know, a pretty low budget cable show where the jokes are maybe non sequiturs and awkwardness.
Mm.
To being this consistent figure in, what, four major DC properties now?
Let's see. The Suicide Squad, the movie.
Yep. Then Peacemaker, the series.
Shazam, Fury of the Gods, that credit scene appearance.
And now the upcoming animated series, Creature Commandos.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Four. That's not just, like, a guest spot. That's becoming part of the franchise furniture.
It really is.
Here,
it's
here.
Like he's a key piece of the high-level plumbing for that whole universe now.
So the big takeaway here, before we dive deeper, is really about longevity. How do you do that? How do you move from that specialized niche comedy writing and acting to being trusted by someone like James Gunn with a pretty pivotal role in this massive, globally recognized IP? It shows Agee as like a multi-tool professional.
That's a great way to put it. A multi-tool. He knows how to operate in basically every format there is.
Yeah.
Animation, streaming TV, late night writing rooms, big budget feature films.
Mm-hmm.
He's done it.
And that sheer volume, the diversity of the credits. You mentioned writing, was it hundreds of episodes of late night?
Yeah, over 300 for Kimmel alone. Plus roles in huge animated shows, mm-hmm. playing in punk bands.
Right, the music side too.
And then carrying this major franchise character.
Mm.
It tells you his value in Hollywood isn't just one thing. It's this comprehensive utility.
So he didn't just like wait around for acting gigs.
No, it seems like he was always building this massive, diverse skill set.
Mm-hmm.
So when a producer looks at his resume, they don't just see quirky character actor.
They see someone who can, what, write the script, maybe punch up jokes on set.
Uh-huh. Voice a monster and nail the deadpan delivery of that stressed bureaucrat.
Yeah.
He's like a creative problem solver.
Mm, that makes sense. That kind of deep utility, that's what gets you 25 years in the business, right?
It has to be a huge part of it, yeah.
So to really understand that resilience, we got to go back to the beginning. Section two in our notes, the foundation. This is where he built those core muscles, right? The writing, the music, before most people knew him from TV.
Absolutely. And the writing core is probably the most disciplined engine behind it all. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel Live, we found credits for 337 episodes.
Wow. 337. That's not just dabbling.
No way. That's years of intense, high-output joke writing. And think about the environment made your late-night show. It's about as rigorous as it gets.
Okay, walk us through that. What does that kind of pressure cooker demand? You know, 337 episodes means living on that relentless 24-hour news and joke cycle. How does that grind shape someone's skills later on?
Well, it's basically boot camp for comedic timing and structure. Late night writing, it forces you to instantly grab onto current events.
Right, what happened today? What's everyone talking about?
Yeah, and then rapidly generate jokes that fit a very specific rhythm, usually that classic setup punchline structure.
Yeah.
And you have to edit brutally. Kill your darlings constantly.
Because the timing is everything, right?
Yeah.
A joke about some political gaffe or celebrity meltdown.
Yeah.
It's gotta land tonight.
Exactly. It's perishable. So when you spend years writing literally thousands of jokes that need to hit perfectly, right now, that knowledge just gets baked into you. It becomes instinctual.
And I think you can kind of see that payoff in his acting later. Like when he's John Economos, he's often delivering really dry, high stakes info under pressure, surrounded by absolute absurdity, like Peacemaker himself. But his delivery is so deadpan, so precise, he never winks at the camera. You know?
Right. It feels like that discipline you'd hone writing jokes against a deadline, that precision.
It's interesting because it seems almost the opposite of that loose, maybe improvised feel of some of the alt comedy stuff he was also doing.
But he mastered both.
Yeah.
Which leads right to his other big writing credit from that era, the Andy Milonakis show.
Okay, yeah. That's a totally different beast.
Totally. If Kimmel was, you know, polished network structure, Milonakis was just pure early internet absurdity. Anti-humor. Almost.
Explain that contrast a bit more. How did those writing rooms or sensibilities differ?
Well, Kimmel, you're following the classic rules, right? Build tension, release with a punchline the audience expects and enjoys. The Andy Milonakis show, though, that thrived on, like, purposeful awkwardness, surreal visuals, a really chaotic kind of lo-fi look.
Very influential, that whole MTV2 pre-YouTube vibe.
Hugely influential.
Sure.
So MBDing involved there shows he was comfortable not just with the polished stuff, but also with the raw, uncomfortable, absurdist fringe. He could write the perfect network joke, and he could write the joke that intentionally makes you feel weird.
That ability to play both sides of the comedy street, that's rare.
Very.
Okay, let's pivot then to the music side, because that seems to feed into that alt-comedy sensibility too, right? The sources say his background as a musician actually comes before the big acting and writing fame.
Exactly. We see him playing guitar and bass in different rock bands back in the 90s. And that's, you know, a serious time commitment. It's not just noodling around.
Right. It suggests a real engagement with that creative output.
And it ties him into those specific subcultures, particularly the LA music and comedy scenes, which often overlap quite a bit.
And the material highlights a connection with Brendan Small. No, that name rings about home movies, right?
Right.
And Death Clock.
Yes.
Yeah.
The mighty Death Clock from Metalocalypse.
Yeah.
That collaboration is really telling. Small's work, especially Death Clock, it needs serious musical chops.
Oh, yeah. Those guys could actually play.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it's blended seamlessly with this really niche, often super specific, kind of nerdy, aggressive humor. So Gadji working with Small just reinforces his roots in that specific blend of technical skill and alternative comedy.
And he kept using those skills, didn't he? Even after getting known for acting, like playing bass in a commercial.
Yeah, for the video game Rocksmith 2014. So he's bringing that musical proficiency back into the commercial sphere. It's another tool in the toolkit.
But the really interesting musical move, timing-wise, was more recent. The sources mention a comedy punk album called Scab.
Yes. Released September 4th, 2021. Now think about that timing.
Okay, 2021. The Suicide Squad came out that summer. He was just hitting big time globally as John Economos.
Exactly. So why release a comedy punk album right then? What does that suggest?
Maybe. Keeping a foot in his old world and not letting the big franchise define him completely.
I think that's thought on. It feels like a conscious move to say, hey, I'm still this guy too. You know, releasing something kind of raw, aggressive, very genre specific while you're playing this button down bureaucrat in a massive franchise.
It's a way of holding on to that alt comedy edge.
Totally. It reminds the industry, maybe reminds himself, that his creative interests are still broad. It stops him from being typecast just by the suit and tie. It's like a career stabilizer, you know, keeps him connected to that comedy world that kind of birthed him, prevents maybe burnout too.
That makes a lot of sense. And that commitment to being a creator, a maker, not just a performer. You see that even in his earliest screen credits. We're going way back now, like year 2000.
Yeah, the very first credits listed show that DIY approach. The Bogus Witch Project in 2000, it was one of those Blair Witch parodies.
Oh, right. There were a few of those.
Yeah. and for the segment in that called The Griffith Witch Project. The sources confirm A.G. wasn't just in it. He was also the director and the producer.
Wow. Okay, that's the definition of rolling up your sleeves. If you want something made back then, especially low-budget comedy, you often just had to do it all yourself.
Pretty much. And that experience directing, producing, acting, probably holding the boom mic, getting coffee, it must give you an immediate, like, 360-degree view of how a set works.
Which probably makes you incredibly useful later on when you're on much bigger sets. Producers must love that.
You'd think so, yeah. And we see the slow build of him appearing on screen physically, starting around then, too.
Yeah.
Little shorts like Kicked in the Nuts in 2003.
Oh.
And then bigger tie-ins with his comedy circle like Sarah Silverman's concert film, Jesus is Magic. In 2005, he's listed as Guy in Wings.
Guy in Wings, classic early credit.
Isn't it? And by 2006, he's in indie films like Sleeping Dogs Lie.
Uh-huh.
So these early years, it's just constant dedicated involvement in that L.A. comedy scene. Writer, director, musician, performer. It's all feeding into this network.
Which perfectly sets up the next phase, right? Section 3. The Comedy Central and sitcom years, this is where he really becomes known as this specialist for really specific, memorable, recurring characters.
Absolutely. And the breakout, no question, was the Sarah Silverman program, playing Stephen Ed Meyron III. He was in 32 episodes, 2007 to 2010.
That role totally established his unique thing, didn't it? That kind of masterful mix of deadpan sincerity and just profound awkwardness.
It really did. And he was critical for that show because, you know, it was built on Sarah's character being extremely surreal, often kind of sociopathic.
Mm-hmm.
A.G.'s character, Steve, he became the necessary straight man, or maybe not straight man, but the emotional anchor. He reacted to the craziness like a normal, albeit slightly pathetic, person might.
Yeah, he grounded the absurdity.
Exactly. And that showed he had the comedic weight to actually anchor a premise, which is a really valuable skill, making this surreal feel somehow real through reaction.
And after that show, he just became this go-to guy, didn't he? One of the most reliable utility players in TV comedy through the 2010s. Not always the main plot, but always stealing scenes, adding this unforgettable flavor.
The prime example has to be New Girl.
Oh, Outside Dave. Yes.
Right. Outside Dave. Between 2013 and 2017, he's in 13 episodes. Now, this character was totally on the fringes, a homeless guy living near the loft.
Barely interacted with the main plot sometimes.
Hardly ever.
Yeah.
Yet he became arguably one of the most quoted, most beloved side characters on the entire show. How does that happen?
Good question. What's the magic there? Limited screen time, huge impact.
I think it boils down to just sheer commitment and his physical presence. The character was pure, random absurdity. Jave existed sort of outside the logic of the main romantic comedy stuff.
Right.
And A.G. played him with total deadpan commitment. He used his, you know, kind of imposing size, but also this unique, slightly rambling way of talking.
Yeah.
It created instant comedic shorthand. You didn't need a backstory. Mm-hmm. His brief, weird appearances were always these perfect little punchlines the writers could just drop in.
High impact, low effort for the script. That's smart writing and smart performing.
It really is. That's comedic craftsmanship.
And he showed he could do that same kind of memorable side character thing across really different types of shows, too. Like, Compare his work on Superstore versus You're the Worst.
Yeah, great comparison. On Superstore, that's 2016 to 2021, he played Isaac for 12 episodes.
Yeah.
That's a broader network workplace comedy, more relatable, grounded humor generally.
Mm-hmm. Big ensemble cast.
Then you have You're the Worst, 2014 to 2017, much sharper show, often darker, really cynical cable comedy. And he played Dutch in 6 episodes there.
So going from the big, bright Cloud Nine store to the kind of messed up world of Gretchen and Jimmy, that shows serious range in terms of fitting the tone.
Absolutely. Adaptability again.
Yeah.
He can be the slightly goofy employee in Superstore and then pivot to being, you know, the more abrasive, maybe emotionally stunted character needed for the dark humor of You're the Worst.
And this utility just meant he popped up everywhere, didn't he? Like the credits list, Children's Hospital, Two Broke Girls, just 2 episodes each, but memorable.
Yeah. And even Community. 2 different appearances playing 2 different characters, David in one, and then famously the DJ at the school dance.
Oh, the DJ. Yeah, Bear Down for Midterms, that episode. His delivery was perfect for Community's very specific high concept style. Just drop in, nail the weirdness, and drop out.
Exactly. And then you see guest spots on huge shows like Modern Family.
Tommy, right, in 2016.
Yep. And Accidentally on Purpose, Happy Endings, The League.
Mm.
It's like if a sitcom needed that slightly off-kilter but totally reliable comedic energy for a scene or two, AG was clearly on the casting director's speed dial.
And he wasn't just acting in sitcoms. He was also engaging with the comedy world as himself, right? Like on panel shows and stuff.
Yeah, that's another layer. Being a regular on At Midnight for 17 episodes, that's significant. That show was tough.
How so? What did At Midnight demand?
It was basically raw, unscripted performance. You're riffing on internet prompts, often in real time. It's improv, but structured around joke formats. It forces you to draw on that quick, sharp joke writing skill.
The Kimmel skill set again?
Totally. Doing that keeps your comedy brain sharp, and it keeps you visible within the industry with your peers.
And he also appeared as Steve Age in shows that were kind of about the comedy scene itself, right?
Exactly. He was on Marc Maron's show, Maron, in the episode Steel Johnson. And he popped up on Judd Apatow's Crashing in 2017. So he's not just performing characters, he's part of the actual fabric, the narrative of that modern stand-up and all comedy world.
One more quick hit from this era, Drunk History, gotta mention that.
Oh yeah, he played Harry Reader in the World War II episode.
Now, Drunk History is a unique challenge. You're acting out a historical story, but you have to lip sync and react to a narrator who is, well, completely hammered.
Yeah, it sounds simple, maybe, but it's actually really hard. You have to maintain comedic composure, commit to the physical pantomime, and match the often slurred, rambling timing of the narrator. It's physically demanding.
And requires serious commitment to the bit.
Totally. It's just another tick in the box of highly useful, game-for-anything comedic performer.
Okay, that feels like a good bridge into Section 4, the voice work portfolio. Because if live action showed his versatility in physical comedy and character types, voice work lets him just explode beyond any physical limitations.
Absolutely. Voice acting is just,
yeah,
it's crucial for a long, sustainable career these days. And the sources show Aegis has built an incredible resume here, working with some of the biggest animated shows out there, often for years.
Let's start with a giant, Adventure Time. 9 episodes between 2011 and 2016, he played various characters. What's the vibe there, vocally?
Well, Adventure Time is defined by that really strange, sprawling, dreamlike world. The voices need to fit that often whimsical, maybe a bit abstract, sometimes melancholic. It requires a certain flexibility.
Right. Less about sharp jokes, more about character and tone.
Yeah. Now, contrast that with his work on Rick and Morty, which, impressively, the sources track from 2014 all the way to potentially 2025. That's over a decade.
Wow. 11 years on Rick and Morty. That's real staying power.
Yeah.
So how are the vocal demands different there compared to Adventure Time?
Oh, totally different. Rick and Morty is all about high concept, super fast paced humor, often loaded with like fake science jargon or philosophical rants.
Right. Very dense dialogue.
Exactly. So the voices need to be distinct. Yeah. But they also have to be delivered with incredible precision and speed, often with a kind of deadpan or slightly aggressive sci-fi edge. He voiced characters like a giant, a restaurant owner.
So Adventure Time, maybe more loose and abstract vocally. Yeah. Rick and Morty, much more technically precise to make the complex jokes land.
You got it. And Ezra's ability to nail both those specific styles just shows incredible vocal versatility.
And we also see him on other huge animated hits, like Bob's Burgers, Another Long Run, 2011 to 2022.
Yep. And network stuff like American Dad, The Cleveland Show. He really covered the animation map.
And he kept branching out into different styles too, right? Not just sticking to one kind of animated comedy.
Definitely not. He worked on regular show, voicing characters like Corny and Cowboy. He was on Close Enough as Davey Wegman. And more recently, jumping into that mythological comedy, Krapopolis.
Voicing Heracles, no less.
Yeah, Heracles. Across 2 episodes so far. Now, voicing a character like Heracles, even in a comedy, it shows he could drop that contemporary slacker vibe when needed and deliver something maybe a bit more epic, or at least fitting for that setting.
It's just more range. But he also kept a foot in the more specialized or cult web stuff too, right? Even with voice work.
Oh, yeah. Crucial for maintaining that original alt comedy cred. The web series Yacht Rock from back in 2005.
Yeah,
genius stuff.
So good. Very niche.
Totally. And he played specific musicians. Steve Porcaro from Toto, and Papa Mortar, Georgia Moroder's fictional dad. To do that well, you need this almost academic knowledge of 70s soft rock history and the ability to do spot-on parody. It speaks volumes about his specific cultural awareness.
And then there's Harmon Quest from 2016. He voiced Tech Powers. Now, Harmon Quest was wild.
It really was. A fascinating experiment. It's live Dungeons & Dragons gameplay, but then they animate the action based on what happens.
So performing on that requires what insane improv skills.
Totally. extreme improvisation, committing to a character voice on the fly, and reacting instantly to the chaos of Dan Harmon and his friends playing D&D. You have to maintain the persona while the game goes off the rails.
That sounds like the ultimate test, blending improv, voice acting, and character work all at once.
It really is. It's the perfect intersection of almost all his skills.
And even earlier, like House of Cosby's in 2005, voicing Housekeeping Cosby. That shows he was always part of that early internet animation scene, right? Willing to jump into projects made by his peers.
Yeah, staying connected to the grassroots stuff, the emerging digital media. That keeps you relevant.
And finally, in this voice section, all that skill translates into video games, too. Another big area for performers.
Yep. He voiced Skullraker in the heavy metal game Brutal Legend back in 2009.
Which fits perfectly with the Brendan Small connection.
Totally. And then, brilliantly, he voiced the ancient psychic Tandem War Elephant in LEGO Dimensions in 2015.
Laughs. Okay, just the name alone. Ancient psychic Tandem War Elephant. That's a gift for a voice actor.
Isn't it? It just lets you go wild. And it reinforces the main point about voice work for him. It lets him completely escape physical typecasting. He can be anything. A giant, a mythological hero, a weird elephant.
That range plus the reliability. It just provides this huge safety net, professionally, and artistic freedom, too.
Yeah, it makes him that true Swiss Army knife of performance we talked about. He's got a tool for basically any job.
Okay. Which brings us, finally, to the climax of this versatility tour. Section 5, the blockbuster pivot. This is where Steve Agree, the reliable character actor and voice guy, suddenly steps into the global spotlight as John Economos in the DC universe.
Yeah, this is the big one, the career capstone.
Yeah, maybe.
It really shows the ultimate trust placed in him, particularly by James Gunn. It's just a completely different scale of production and exposure compared to his sitcom work.
It all kicked off with the Suicide Squad in 2021, right? He's introduced there as John Economos, one of Amanda Waller's key guys in the control room.
Yep. The nervous, kind of put upon, dry-witted tech guy trying to manage the unmanageable Task Force X from afar.
But there's a crucial detail about his work on that specific film, something the sources highlight that really underscores this whole utility player theme.
Ah, yes. This is the really fascinating bit. AG wasn't just the actor playing John Economos on that set. He was also the on-set stand-in and physical performer for King Shark.
Okay, let's really spend a minute on this, because it's not just like a fun fact. It sounds like a massive logistical challenge, and it says so much about what he brings to a production. Explain the demands of doing both those jobs on the same movie.
Right. Think about it. This is where his whole career kind of comes together. You have Steve Agee, the actor, needing to be present, probably in a suit and tie, delivering his lines as Economos' often dry technical exposition, focused.
Standard acting job, basically.
But then, maybe moments later, or on different days, he has to completely switch gears and do a totally different physical job. He has to put on the motion capture gear, or at least be the physical reference on set for King Shark.
Who is what? A 7-foot-tall, massively built CGI great white shark.
Exactly. Voiced by Sylvester Stallone, no less. So AG is providing the physical presence for this huge digital character while also playing his own human character in the same film.
So what skills would he even use for that? Like, how does being outside Dave or Steve Myron prepare you to physically embody a giant CGI shark man?
Well, King Shark wasn't just a brute, right? There was a specific physicality, this sort of lumbering menace, but also this surprising, almost childlike awkwardness and innocence.
Yeah, Nanawi.
Right. So the sources suggest AG used his deep understanding of physical comedy, especially playing awkwardness, playing characters who are maybe uncomfortable in their own skin, using his size effectively to provide the actual physical blueprint for King Shark's body language.
So he wasn't just like a mannequin standing there for height reference.
No, much more than that. He was providing the blocking, the sight lines for other actors, and the specific comedic physicality. The timing of how King Shark might tilt his head, or the weight behind a clumsy movement, or how he interacts with props. The animators then build off that human performance foundation.
Wow. So he's performing two distinct characters at the same time, essentially. One with his voice and face, the other with his entire body as a physical template for CGI. He's bridging the gap between live-action performance and digital effects right there on set.
Precisely. And think how valuable that makes him. He's reliable on screen as Economos, and he understands the technical physical needs of integrating a major CGI character seamlessly. Normally, that's two, maybe three different people's jobs, the actor, the mocap performer, the stand-in.
That level of combined artistic and technical utility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can see why a director like Gunn would latch onto that. It must make complex scenes much easier to shoot.
Absolutely. Extremely attractive for high-budget filmmaking.
And clearly, Gunn recognized that value, because Economos didn't just disappear after the movie. He brought AGR over to the Peacemaker series on HBO Max in 2022, right? As a main cast member.
Huge vote of confidence.
Yeah.
Economos went from being a supporting player in the control room to a core member of Peacemaker's dysfunctional team on the ground.
And that really let him stretch, didn't it? The character became much more developed.
Oh, totally. He became kind of the reluctant moral center sometimes, or at least the perpetually exasperated straight man reacting to Peacemaker's everything. It let Agee show off more dramatic range while still leveraging that perfect deadpan comedic timing.
And the DC universe wasn't done with Economos or Agee even then. His place in the bigger picture got cemented in 2023.
Yep, the Shazam. Fury of the Gods mid-credit scene. He shows up alongside Jennifer Holland's Amelia Harcourt recruiting Shazam.
Those mid-credit scenes, they're basically signposts from the studio, aren't they? They tell the audience, pay attention, this character, this plot thread, it continues. It matters.
Exactly. His presence there basically guaranteed that John Economos remains an active piece on the big DC chessboard, connecting different parts of the universe. He's part of the ongoing infrastructure.
And now it feels like his journey with this character comes full circle in the most versatile way possible. The sources list the upcoming Creature Commandos animated series, and he's voicing Economos there too.
This is the ultimate proof of his adaptability across all media. He originated the character in live-action film. He expanded him significantly in live-action TV. And now he's transitioning that same character into the new DCU's animated slate.
So he is John Economos, regardless of the format. Live-action film, live-action TV, animated TV. He's the constant.
He's the anchor for that character's consistency across all these different platforms. It's pretty remarkable.
And just to round out this whole blockbuster phase, it's worth noting that even while doing all this intense DC franchise work, he was still taking other interesting film roles, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We see him dip his toe into the other big superhero sandbox Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
He had that small role as Geth in Guardians of the Galaxy Voyager back in 2017.
Another James Gunn connection there, obviously.
Showing he was already playing in that huge budget arena. But he also did stuff outside superheroes, like the indie drama Violet in 2021, playing a character named Boris, and the James Gunn-produced horror film Brightburn in 2019.
Ah, the evil Superman premise.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So his filmography during this time shows him juggling superhero spectacle, dark horror, character-driven drama. It's all built on that foundation we talked about, saying yes to interesting work, bringing his skills wherever they fit, regardless of genre or medium.
Okay. So that brings us to wrapping this all up. Section 6, synthesis and final takeaway. We've basically charted, 25 years of continuous, incredibly diverse work.
Yeah, from late-night writing room.
90s punk bands to
major animation voice booths.
To cult classic sitcoms.
And finally, to being a key player in the DC universe. It's quite a ride.
That strategic leap you mentioned earlier, from being the comedic anchor on a niche cable show like Sarah Silverman, to becoming this operational anchor for a multi-billion dollar franchise. It really is an amazing case study.
And for you, the listener, that's the key takeaway, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Steve Alige's career path is just this ultimate masterclass in professional adaptation. He didn't just react to changes in the industry, the rise of streaming, new animation tech.
He actively jumped into all of it.
Yeah. Across every possible role. Writer, musician, physical performer for mocap, voice actor, character actor. He did it all.
It feels like he strategically used each part of his background. The writing gave him timing. The music gave him maybe an edge, an alt persona. The sitcom work made him super reliable.
So reliable that he got rewarded with this core franchise role that fascinatingly required him to integrate all those previous skills, especially with the King Shark stuff.
And that emphasis on utility, on being the craftsperson who can step in and do multiple difficult, tonally different things, often at the same time, that feels like the secret sauce to his longevity.
I think so. He wasn't hired for the Suicide Squad or Peacemaker because he was, a household name celebrity. He was hired because he was supremely useful. He could do the job of three people, sometimes literally playing two characters on the same set.
Okay. Which leads us perfectly into our final provocative thought. Building on everything we've discussed, especially that incredible King Shark duality we've established, started as writer-musician, became known as a character actor, then landed this role where he was both the main human character, Economos, and the physical performer underpinning the big CGI character, King Shark.
Right. That unique blend, the behind-the-scenes physicality, the deep history and comedy and improv, and now this high-profile on-screen visibility. It raises a really interesting question about what could be next, especially in performance capture.
Yeah. Like, how could a future director really capitalize on all of that specific experience, the physical comedy chops and the comfort level with the digital CGI process?
He's literally done the physical comedy groundwork for a globally recognized character like King Shark.
Yeah.
So could we see a future where age isn't just the stand-in or the reference performer?
Yeah.
But gets elevated.
You mean like into a full performance captured role himself, like what Andy Serkis did with Gollum or Caesar or Terry Notary with King Kong?
Exactly. Where his unique physical presence, his specific comedic timing, is the primary foundation for an entirely digital character. It would allow him to fully merge that physical comedy past with his blockbuster present and future.
The capability is definitely there, isn't it? He's proven the physical commitment with King Shark. He obviously has the comedic timing down cold.
Totally. So imagine a director needs a non-human character, maybe an alien or a monster, that requires really sophisticated, grounded, but maybe awkward or unusual comedic movement. AGE seems like the ideal candidate.
It feels like the logical next evolution, doesn't it? Giving him the keys to create a brand new type of digital character, one that specifically needs an actor who can convincingly shift between, say, low-key bureaucratic stillness and big, monstrous, yet funny physical performance.
That would be the ultimate synthesis, wouldn't it, of Stephen Douglas AG's entire multifaceted career. It feels like the next challenge for someone who's basically proven he can do, well, pretty much everything else.